As 2017 comes to a close, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite Louisiana Eats moments from the last year. Like when our house band, Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, visited the studio to discuss their new, healthier diet.
You know, we're getting up there in age, Poppy. We're not young bucks anymore. We've got to put some vitamins in these tanks.
And when Jeremiah Tower shared stories about his groundbreaking tenure at Chez Panisse, including the time he was turned away from his initial interview.
And then I thought, wait a minute. This just cost me $5.25 on the bus here and to go back. So I went back inside and I said, look, you told me to be here at 6 o'clock. I was, and I want my interview.
It's our Louisiana Eats Year in Review. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Russian President Vladimir Putin has personally submitted the paperwork to register as a candidate in Russia's presidential election in March. NPR's Lucy Ann Kim reports Putin's arch-rival, Alexei Navalny, was denied registration as a candidate just 2 days ago.
To the clatter of camera shutters on live TV, President Putin showed up at the Central Election Commission in Moscow to hand over a pile of documents. Supporters of the president chose him as their candidate on Tuesday, but the Kremlin said Putin was too busy to attend his own nomination. On Sunday, opposition leader Alexei Navalny went through the same procedure, only the next day the election commission said he was ineligible to run because of a prior conviction for embezzlement. Navalny, who has spent the past year building a nationwide campaign network, argued with the head of the election commission and said his criminal record was fabricated to prevent his candidacy. He's now telling supporters to boycott the election and participate in nationwide protests next month. The Kremlin says calls for a boycott may be illegal. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
The French government is scrambling to meet President Emmanuel Macron's deadline to get migrants off the country's streets and out of forest hideouts by year's end. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports migrants are still setting up tent camps on Paris streets, even though the structures are taken down daily.
Macron's government is ramping up expulsions, raising pressure on economic migrants, and allowing divisive ID checks in emergency shelters. Critics say the French president's increasingly tough policy on migrants contradicts his image as a humanist who defeated an anti-immigrant far-right candidate for the presidency.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reporting from Paris. U.S. unemployment rates have fallen to a 17-year low. Steve Beckner reports that a closely watched barometer of future home sales is suggesting that trend will continue.
Trouble in the housing industry led to broader problems for the financial system and the economy 9 years ago, but with the economy back to good health, the housing sector is booming again. Sales of new and existing homes rose sharply in November. Home prices are surging. The latest sign of strength is a rise in pending home sales, a forward-looking indicator of future purchases. After a 3.5% leap in October, a decline was expected last month. Instead, there was a modest rise in contracts to buy previously owned homes. The National Association of Realtors says the biggest problem is that too few homes are on the market. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Stocks are continuing to trade higher on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 22 points at 24,768. The Nasdaq Composite up a point. The S&P 500 up a fraction. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Telegrams are about to fade into history in Belgium. As Terry Schultz reports, they're officially ending this week after 171 years.
Squeezed out by mobile phones, email, and instant messaging, the telegram is already history in most countries. Telegrams are sent by emailing, phoning, or faxing text to a telecommunications company, where it's then printed and delivered for a fee of about $30. In Britain, where it was invented, telegrams haven't been used since 1982. In the U.S., not since 2006. In Belgium, there are still a handful of operators who can send and receive the dispatches, and customers who use them, mostly bailiffs. That's not enough to keep the service running, so as of December 29th, it will cease to exist here, too. Operators report a surge in orders in recent days as Belgians use telegrams one last time to send holiday greetings. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Many parts of the U.S. are dealing with bitterly cold temperatures and heavy snowfall this week. Northwestern Pennsylvania is seeing lake-effect snow. Some 60 inches have fallen in the city of Erie this week. National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Orovec.
Lake effect snows are going to diminish somewhat later today, but some other general non-lake effect snows are going to spread across the Great Lakes in the wake of that. And then later on in the week, as we get another shot of cold air pressing southeast, where the lake effect snows are going to pick up again.
Wind chill advisories or warnings are in effect for all of North Dakota and Wisconsin. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. What an amazing year 2017 has been for Louisiana Eats. The New Orleans Press Club presented us with our fifth award in just 3 years. And we were recognized for our work nationally with a Taste Award. Our show about addiction and recovery in the hospitality business won first place in the drinks and beverage category, beating out our liquor-laden competition from coast to coast. That alone is quite noteworthy. We took our listeners along to the Hot Tamale Festival in Greenville, Mississippi, and captured the great magnificent Jeremiah Tower himself for a sit-down interview about how Anthony Bourdain came to make a documentary about Jeremiah's life. In this week's show, we're revisiting these moments and some other gems from 2017. We've had a lot of laughs along the way as well. Fellow NPR lover, producer Joe Schreiner, has long wanted to do a Louisiana Eats version of Kai Ryssdal's daily marketplace numbers. In case you missed it, that's in this week's special show as well. So before it's all over, let's give 2017 one more shot on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Lior Lev-Sercars. I'm the owner and founder of La Boite, located in New York City. One point that I try to convey, a message that I try to send, is whether you're a home cook or a professional, you should be using spices in your food on a daily basis. It's not reserved for a certain season of the year. It doesn't have to be a lot. It could be just very few. But do take the time to empty your spice cabinet or drawer as often as possible and taste what's in there.
Chef and spice blender Lior Lev-Sercars has been called a number of things: spice therapist, spice magician, and spice master. He's the purveyor to some of the best chefs across the world. When we sat down with Lior earlier this year, he discussed his career's trajectory from sergeant of the Israeli army to spice savant, and explained how cooks can benefit from exploiting the spice world.
I was born into the worst culinary scene on the planet, which was the 70s in Israel and a kibbutz. But luckily, I was shown better food over my childhood and developed a great passion for food and spices. My parents, without even thinking too much, shaped kind of this love for food from the fact that we traveled a lot with them and they always exposed us to different kinds of food. Some I liked, some I didn't like, but at least I got exposed to it. And I really saw the passion and the beauty and what food could do I cooked and learned how to cook from my mom. I should say without my mom, because she was working late. So I would make lunch or dinner quite often when she was running late. And that's my first hands-on experience in cooking. And then following that, I joined the military, like most young Israelis do, and had to supervise the kitchen staff as part of my duties as a sergeant. Learned a little bit about a different way of cooking. And after that, I just had to get a job like, you know, most people do, and decided that I would try cooking. I found a young guy who had a catering company who loved the idea that I've never learned professionally how to cook, and he decided to teach me how to cook. And that's, I think, the beginning of this more than 20 years love affair with food and the culinary world.
Lior, the first chef who figures largely in your life is a Frenchman whose name is Chef Rollinger.
That is correct, yeah. As part of my culinary studies in Lyon at the Paul Bocuse Institute, you are required to do externships. And my second externships led me to Cancal, a small town in Brittany, working for Olivier Rollinger. And it was kind of a life-changing experience, personally and professionally, the very short 8 months that I spent in Cancal. I found myself surrounded with bags of exotic spices in a French restaurant in France, in Brittany. It didn't make a whole lot of sense at the beginning. And when I started speaking with Olivier about it, it started making more sense, knowing that Saint-Malo was a very important harbor that imported exotic spices and other things from the Far East 300-400 years beforehand. Also, the idea that you could cook local cuisine, but you have to season it somehow. And seasoning, meaning spices, for the most part, do not grow locally. Very few places actually grow them. So, and his ability to transport people and showing them other experiences was thanks to these spices. And that's, I would say, it was my first serious introduction into the world of spices.
So then, once you finished your training in Europe, you had the incredible good fortune of landing with the fabulous Chef Daniel Boulud in New York City.
Again, a kind of an ironic thing. I lived in France for 5 years and needed a break from France, French people, and Lyon. And out of all things, ended up working for a Frenchman from Lyon in New York. I love Daniel dearly. We spent nearly 6 years working together, and I owe him a lot, teaching me about quality and generosity and hospitality. And I also mainly thank him, and he's well aware of that, for the fact that I am no longer in a kitchen every day. Is him being able to open my eyes to the idea that you can express your culinary knowledge even after 20 years as a chef in other domains, whether you're a spice blender, whether you're a writer, a journalist, and so on. There's a lot that can be done with this beautiful world of the culinary world.
So you make the decision to become an entrepreneur, and we can all go shopping with you at La Boite Online, no matter where we are in the world. However, in Hell's Kitchen in New York City, would you take us on a typical shopping experience at your store?
Absolutely. So when somebody comes to our store, and the store is open to the public, we don't just serve the professional industry. It's important for myself or for the great staff that works at La Boite to understand who you are and help you understand that you are you, whether you like it or not. And if your big thing is just microwaving frozen food, which is totally fine by me, or if you're, on the contrary, butchering your own animals, that's great. There are different ways that you should or can season your food and what your likes and dislikes. I often like ask people what they hate before I ask them what they like. And I find that very liberating for a lot of people. And then after that, we could start suggesting a few spice blends that we think would work. My goal is to have you leave us and run as fast as you can to a kitchen nearby and start cooking or start eating and experimenting with the spices, knowing that we make blends that are not meant for just one thing. We invite you to try each and every of the 80 or so blends on anything from coffee, tea, savory, sweet beverages. Just try them. Some might not work that great, but for the most part, they will work and you will never look back.
Lior, I think there might still be some confusion in people's mind about the difference between herbs and spices. Would you demystify that?
Sure. To me, there is no difference. My definition of spices is completely different than the dictionaries. To me, spices equal seasoning. So everything you choose to season your food or beverage with, to me, is a spice. Whether it's sugar, whether it's berries, cheese, as long as it's in a dry form, to me, it's a spice. So there's really no distinction between herbs and spices or grains and rhizomes and barks and berries. And we use cheese powder, we use seafood powder. They're spices to me. I would say this. You have to taste and educate yourself the same way that you would not buy a bad piece of meat or fish or vegetable. Why would you buy something that you have no idea what it tastes like? And maybe you don't like salt or maybe you don't like pepper. And that's fine by me. Don't have them in your kitchen. The fact that recipes call for seasoning with salt and pepper doesn't mean you have to use salt and pepper. You could use hot sauce. Oh, you could use caper or fish sauce to replace your salt if that's, but embrace yourself and have what you need at home, not what you're told.
You mentioned your work with the professional trade. How do you get into the mind and the palate of a chef?
In order for me to create a blend for a chef or a professional or a bartender for that matter, we have to start dating in a way. I would like to know who they are, you know, what they like to cook, what they like to eat, so that I understand. Even if we are talking about a particular dish, my goal is to make a blend that is timeless. To make a blend, I need an idea, a concept, a story. I do this exercise. I said, this blend is going to be great because, and I try to complete that sentence. And if it works, then I could get going. So it could be a person, it could be a place, an experience, a dish that I ate. And I really write down the keywords that describe that experience. Thanks to the 10 or more years of professional blending experience that I have, I can put next to these words spices that will represent coarse or yellow or hot or sour. And then I have a little ingredient list all of a sudden. And then I start limiting the amount of things. And I pretty much end up with a recipe right then and there. That allows me to go to my spice shelves and start grabbing these 6-10 ingredients and measuring them very precisely on a scale. Also deciding what I will grind, what I will not grind, and to what degree. Will I toast some of them or will I not? Not everything needs to be or should be. The rest is pretty mechanical. It's toasting, grinding, combining. I never, ever judge a spice blend right then and there for a couple of reasons. A, the temperature is still pretty warm. The second is that the people that will purchase that spice blend will never see it the same way. So it might be a month before they actually see it. I would like to be in their shoes a month later and to know what they're going to experience.
Now, you've put your hands on I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of spices in your lifetime. Is there a holy grail of spice discovery that you're waiting to happen in your life?
I don't know. My goal that I hope that I will never reach is to create a spice blend that will capture the scent of rain or after the rain, which is to me the most fascinating scent ever. I like tobacco and I like rubber and I like spices. I'm intrigued by scents to begin with and flowers. The holy grail to me is the scent after the rain and in different parts of the world because it smells differently. And I really hope I'm never going to get there because then what?
World-renowned spice expert, Lior Lev-Sercars. Next up is a piece from our April Fool's show featuring our favorite huntsman, Isaac Toups. But don't be fooled. This is all a true story.
So lighting a fire is essential to barbecue and outdoor cooking, and I think surviving. I think it's one of the things they should teach you in high school. You know, sure, I got the periodic table memorized, but can't light a fire.
The ability to survive in the wilderness is something that Chef Isaac Toups takes enormous pride in.
I could hunt you animals, grow you crops, cure the animals, cook the animals, tan their hides.
It sometimes seems as though there's very little the Top Chef star can't do. And that includes taking on new challenges, like trying his hand at high-speed game hunting in Woodville, Mississippi.
Or like the locals say, Woodville. Ooh, Wobble.
I'll let Isaac take it from here.
So this is the last hunt of deer season. I haven't shot a deer. I'm pretty aggravated. I hadn't even shot my gun besides sighting it in. So a bunch of rabbits. We were coming back from the trail. Brother picked me up. I'm riding. He's like, you know what? I'm going to shoot a rabbit. He's like you're going to hit a rabbit. I'm like, I know I'm not going to hit a rabbit. Like I'm not really that good of a shot with a pistol anyway. Anyway, so I'm just going to shoot at one, and you know I'm not going to shoot one across my brother. So I'm like, wait for one of the roots. Like, oh, look, there's one. Boom. We're going like 20 miles an hour. Like, you didn't hit that. I'm like, I know I didn't hit it. We come up to it. Rabbit's dead with a hole through it. He's just like, drop dead. We're like, oh, my God. Moving four-wheeler, moving rabbit with a pistol, and Wyatt Earp came out and took him down. Pretty proud of myself. It saved the season. Like, didn't kill a deer, but I wired up the rabbit. So I took that rabbit, skinned it, because you know, I'm going to shoot some, I'm going to eat it. We cooked it down in bacon and tomato. It's the only things we had left at the camp. The hunters were shocked at how good this was. You know, I'm a chef, don't worry. So the bacon and the tomato, it's like, this is the best rabbit I've ever had. I'm like, actually, it came out really good. And I took the hide and spread it out, nailed it, salted it, and then reduced my own urine in a beer can and painted that on. It's natural cure. You ever heard the term piss poor? That comes from people actually selling their piss to the tanneries to reduce for curing hides. Still done across the world. I knew that and then brought it home and made my wife a purse with that rabbit hide. My wife has never taken that purse outside of this house and gave it to my daughter. I was fairly offended.
Professional chef and amateur rabbiteer, Isaac Toups.
Country boy. Got a shaggy dog, country boy, up a holler log. Well, he comes in a run when you pick up your gun and with a shell or two and your dog at you. When you get your rabbit, you'll skin his hide. He's gonna be good fried country boy.
When we come back from a short break, we make a stop in Greenville, Mississippi for some hot tamales. Then we have a visit with the Louisiana Eats house band, Johnny Sketchin' the Dirty Notes. Stay tuned.
Country boy. Dirty Rice, satisfying your Louisiana music RV since 1991. Join either me, Bill Bolins, or Mr. Lee Klein Peter. For the best in Louisiana music, Cajun, Zydeco, blues, swamp pop, you name it, we got a whole lot of rock and roll too. That's Dirty Rice, every Saturday night at 8:30 to 10 p.m. right here on KRBS 88.7 FM and on the internet at krbs.org.
Later today on This American Life, a sailor named Mike Love explains what it's like to fall asleep while actually piloting a little boat around a huge Navy ship.
And then I just remember hearing the engines kind of, and I just hear like love, love, love. And I was like, whoop. And I looked up and holy cow, you know, swung full right. I was maybe 60 meters from the side of the ship.
Keeping your eyes open. That's later today.
Tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Dan Phillips inviting you to Funkify Your Life Thursday afternoons at 1 and Friday nights at 9 right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans Mid-City. In 2017, Louisiana Eats took you along to Greenville, Mississippi for the city's annual Delta Hot Tamale Festival. Tamale makers from across the state gathered downtown to compete in a cook-off. As they set up, I had the opportunity to meet the vendors and find out what it takes to make an award-winning tamale. Oh my, did I find some characters along the way.
When you die, and I die and you go to heaven, if you look me up, I'd be the one making the hot tamale in heaven.
And what is your name, sir?
My name is Willie Harmon.
I know that goes without saying about your tamales, because that's all anybody could talk about was hot tamale heaven.
That's right. If you really want to know the truth, when it comes to hot tamale, I'm God. You hear me?
Amen. That's we're
right.
In heaven.
That's right.
My name is Valley Scott Mitchell. The reason they're so good, we put a lot of tender love and care in each tamale we make.
It's all about the love.
Yes.
My name is Malcolm Dye, and my hot tamales are sold as Mr. Hot Tea Mollies.
And where are your tamales originating from?
Out of Cleveland, Mississippi.
I run Katie's Kitchen. I do beef, chicken, venison, seafood, Mexican, and eggplant tamales. I'm not in it to win or to say that I have the best hot tamale. My customers have to tell me that, but I just love to cook.
Hi, it's Jean Weathers, and it's Mama's Hot Tamales.
Well, it's a lot of work making tamales, isn't it?
I have a little machine. It's called the Tamale King. But anyway, and I put my meat in there, and it squirts them out so that they'll all come out the same size. And then we hand roll them in the mazam.
We use a beef brisket, and it is a homemade, handmade, and it's made with lots of love.
No machine at all. Handmade, all handmade.
My name is Cynthia McGaugh.
And I'm Rick McGaugh.
My name is Jewel McCain, and I own Solly's Hot Tamales in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Here's the original showing up hot tamale.
And where are you all out at?
Greenville, Mississippi.
Oh, so you're right here local?
Right here locally.
How long have you been making tamales?
Since 1982.
We've been making hot tamales 40 years. Right over there, whenever used to be a store there called Steinmont, and we started off selling hot tamales in a little wooden cart, a little bit bigger than that, with some bicycle tires on it, and now we is USDA approved.
We officially started making hot tamales to sell in the 60s. I've been making tamales since about 1990.
So it's a great family tradition.
Well, actually, I started it, I don't know what my kids are going to do. It might die when I do. I don't know. I hope not. But
surely you're sharing the recipe with them.
I will when I get a little older. I'm only 61 now. I got 20 more years to do this at least. So.
34 years.
34 years. Is it your recipe or is it a family recipe?
No, it's Mr. Solly's recipe. He taught me in 1982, and I've been doing it ever since.
So who was Mr. Solly?
The owner and founder of Solly's Hot Tamales. He started in Vicksburg in 1939.
How many tamales do you make in preparation for the festival?
Anywhere from 250 to 500.
My goodness.
No, it just depends on what time, if I have enough time to do it.
Do you sell out?
I do.
About 900 dozen.
900 dozen?
Yeah.
Well, everybody I talk to keeps telling me about your tamales, so I know you're doing something
good. I'm the man.
How many tamales did you make in preparation for today?
I lost count. All I gotta say is I'm tired of looking at tamales for a while.
The best tamale makers in the hot tamale capital of the world, Greenville, Mississippi. Saturday mornings at 10:59 a.m., when we're waiting for the clock to flip to 11, the anticipation gradually builds until we hear that telltale theme song. Which, of course, was composed and performed for us by none other than Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Do you know what the name of that song is? It's called Let's Eat.
After completing their new album, Sketch, in April, we sat down with the boys to talk about the CD. And, of course, food.
Hi, this is Mark Parody, a.k.a. Johnny Sketch. I play cello, guitar, and I sing for Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Hello, my name's Andre Boren, and sometimes they call me Dirty Johnny. And I play drums and sing with Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Your mother will be so proud.
My name is David Pomerleau, and I sing and play the bass in Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
My name is Omar Ramirez. I am also known as Johnny Rico, and I play the trumpet in Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Welcome back to Louisiana Eats, boys. I'm always thrilled to see you guys.
Hey, Poppy.
So you guys have a new CD coming out.
Yes, we do.
What's the name of it?
It's self-titled.
Sort of self-titled.
It's the word on the cover is Sketch.
Sketch.
But there's no like official name really. It's just Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Tell me why. Go!
Where did you all record the latest CD?
We recorded at a place called the Living Room over in Algiers, underneath the bridge. It's an old church that's been converted into a studio. The guy, Chris George, runs it, and he's got a whole bunch of old musical instruments and studio equipment and a lot of great microphones, and he makes some really nice records over there.
We prepared for this by going to Bay St. Louis, the Comiskey House in Bay St. Louis, and coming up with about 9 songs that we've been playing steadily for the last year and a half or so. So the experience of recording the CD, we were prepared for it. In the past, we've gone in the studio and had to write things in the studio, and this time we were ready to do it.
How long was that Johnny Sketch conference at the Comiskey compound?
The retreat was 2 days.
Just 2 full days.
Wow, and y'all wrote enough music for
it. We actually came up with something like 11 ideas, but of those, I think 9 became songs that are on, or 8 or 9 that became songs on the record.
He's hanging on your lies, see it in your eyes, the way you're stringing him along. So stop for a second.
When y'all work together in that capacity, what is the creative process like?
Well, in this case, it's a kind of a newer approach. We kind of just got together. We had some ideas that we brought that we'd been working on before, and we would just kind of start playing them, and really just, it was the 3 of us, we would just sit together and kind of bash it out until we got somewhere with it and try to come up with an arrangement and then move on and do something else.
Break for lunch.
Yeah, we would go out and wade in the water and hang around, and then we would come back and revisit things until we felt like we came to a stopping point with them. And it's amazing how much you can get done doing that. You know, it really helps to have a starting point. But many of the ideas would just – we would just come in and someone would play something and we would feed off of it. It was very collaborative. It was really different than we've done it in the past in some ways. We've always worked together on songs, but it was very much the three of us kind of getting through it together.
Well, you said and kind of feed on it. So what exactly was the feed fueling that summit?
On that trip, what did we bring? We brought all our own food, and I remember we were trying to get we tried to keep it like reasonably healthy, I think, as I recall.
Yeah, because we wanted to be productive.
Yeah, we didn't bring like a bunch of bags of Doritos and stuff. We're getting up there in age, Poppy. We're not young bucks anymore. We've got to put some vitamins in these tanks, you know.
Oh, okay.
I think we just made Andre cook.
Yeah, I think Dre just cooked everything, probably.
See a stone laid in the sand. What are you eating in the recording studio these days?
We had some like granola bars.
Granola bars.
Yep.
There was a lot of hot tea floating around and emergency pouches for the you know, gotta stay healthy in the studio.
Yeah, and we had things like we were eating a lot of like mixed nuts and there was dried fruit at one point.
We're still very much fueled by sandwiches.
Yeah, that's true, but it was still felt like a bit of a departure. Like we had grown up. I just remember looking around and thinking, this is a pretty responsible group of guys. I don't think any of us drank at all the whole time we were in there. I didn't, or I don't remember drinking much of anything. Might have had a beer or something. But
on older records, we had a producer who would just give us the studio, and we were able to do whatever we wanted. And this was very much the clock's ticking. Every hour is very expensive, so... You know, I think we wanted to order pizzas and sit around and have, you know, big dinners and lunches, but you really can't do that. You have to be quick.
We do well with the deadline.
Well, and honestly, you know, eating a little lighter and kind of snacking throughout the day kept us more on task. Mm-hmm. You know, if you take a big lunch break and you go get a bunch of 12-inch po' boys and... You come back from work to work, and it's a little, you know.
The tempos are a little slower.
Yeah, right. The drums are a little, they're slowing down a little bit.
Y'all are freaking me out. You're acting so grown up.
Don't be fooled. I'm going to go get some cocktails as soon as I leave here. So. And a 12-inch sandwich. Standard fare backstage food is, you know, you get your ice chest full of sodas and beers, and then you get your deli tray, which is like every backstage in America and elsewhere, I'm sure. Little triangle sandwiches with the crust cut off. And hey, don't get me wrong. I think we're all pretty big fans of those.
I can eat a lot of those.
Those sandwiches are pretty good.
Party sandwiches. Those aren't deli.
And well, whatever you want to call them.
New Orleans, party sandwiches.
Okay, party sandwiches, darling. We did have a deal going with tips for a while where we said, hey, Tipitina's. We will grace you with our presence, but we require Popeye's chicken. And they honored that for a while, but I think they've given up on the chicken. We didn't get it the last time.
Oh.
It's probably better. It's not the best pregame food.
It's the after game.
It's an after, yeah. Right. By then, everybody's eating it.
Everybody's eating it, and all that's left is the bones.
Well, yeah. We have had some fun with Popeye's fried chicken before. Remember the time that you all were throwing fried Popeye's hand pies from the stage at around... 2 o'clock in the morning, they were strawberry.
I will never forget that.
Winging those pies from the stage at Tipitina's, that was wild.
It was
People
awesome.
Couldn't believe it.
In this city, we're used to having things thrown to us from the Mardi Gras tradition. But most of that stuff about a week later just kind of looks like garbage, you know? Not garbage per se, but it doesn't serve any purpose. It goes into a bag and you forget about it for 360 days. A Popeye's hand pie has immediate appreciable value, especially at 2 a.m. when you've been drinking at a show. That was like throwing money into the crowd. People's faces lit up. And I think at the Maple Leaf one time we had
a flash mob,
a whole fried chicken flash mob, and we put a bunch of boxes out on the bar, and then we passed boxes over the crowd like they were crowd surfing through, and everybody took a winger. It was so cool. And there's nothing better than watching a crowd that's dancing and eating chicken at the same time. It's a very New Orleans moment for me.
What is it like when you get that new CD in your hand for the very first time?
I'm just glad it's over.
Yeah, I think that's really the main feeling is just good. We finished. By the time you get it, we've heard mixes over and over again. We've finally heard the mastered copy several times. By the time you get the copy, it really is mostly just a feeling of good. We're done now, because it's not like, you know, we get to excitedly put it in and see what it sounds. We already know what it sounds like.
Right.
So when you finally have the copy, it's really nice to see the artwork, to hold it in your hand. It's very satisfying. And you're kind of already like moving on to let's do something with it, you know.
The last time I listened to this record will probably be next month sometime, and then I won't listen to it again for another 5 years.
Well,
you know?
Now you're going to be playing it all the time, right?
Exactly.
Right. Well, and when we sell our first million, I think I'll listen to it again.
Oh, that's a good idea. Well, yeah. We'll see how far we can just make that happen.
This record's going to at least go aluminum, I predict.
Aluminum?
Dozens of copies.
Dozens
sold.
Of copies will be sold.
You're going to get the first copy, Poppy.
Well, thank you,
the Poppy
guys.
Copy, first off the presses. And by the way, thanks so much for including us on your show. It is my favorite radio show in all the land.
Our friends, the Louisiana Eats House Band, Johnny Sketchin' the Dirty Notes.
Like my champagne dry, a little smoke in my eye.
Lafayette, Louisiana is often said to have more restaurants per capita than any other city in the U.S. But is this claim true? Stay tuned, and we'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Give it up to your soul. You better hang on tight. We're gonna find the bump in the night.
This is Bob Gushereau inviting you to tune into the music of yesteryears every Tuesday night at 7. We'll listen to music from the great composers from the first part of the last century, done by performing artists then and the contemporaries of today, with a variety of music from my library and the library of many of my friends. That's the music of yesteryears, Tuesday nights at 7, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Bob Dylan's songs are part of American consciousness, with sources in blues and ballads, ancient and modern poetry, the beauties and absurdities of life, love, and loss. Dylan's contributions to the big river of song are many. In this dark time of year's end, it's How Many Roads? Bob Dylan's Back Pages on American Roots from PRX.
Friday afternoon at 1, right after the Blues Box on KRVS.
There is no better place to be in during the holiday season than in the island of Puerto Rico. So I'm taking you with me on a musical journey of the island during this amazing time, all the way through December until Las Octavitas in mid-January. This is La Bellonera, Thursday at 7 p.m. on KRVS, the 88.7 FM.
Asalto!
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. We'll be right back. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. It's been said that Lafayette, Louisiana, has more restaurants per capita than any other city in the country. But is this claim true? Megan Wyatt, journalist with Lafayette's The Daily Advertiser, did some research to answer this question and published some surprising results. Let's do the numbers. According to Megan's research, Lafayette doesn't even have the most restaurants per capita in the state. With a population of 124,276 and a restaurant count of 445, Lafayette has 3.58 restaurants for every 1,000 residents, ranking it fourth in Louisiana. Ranked third with 3.73 restaurants per 1,000 is Monroe. Baton Rouge is next with 3.9, which brings us to number one. You might think that New Orleans is at the top of our state's list, but as it turns out, with 5.64 restaurants per 1,000 residents, the city of Houma has the most restaurants per capita in Louisiana, almost 200 altogether, serving a population of 34,000. While New Orleans has far and away the most restaurants in the state, around 1,200 in all, the city's dense population brings our per capita ranking down to a modest number 6. While the myth about Lafayette may not be true, locals can take pride in their city's ranking ahead of Austin, Texas, a city known for drawing tourists to its restaurants. Another food town Lafayette ranks ahead of? New York City. I'm Poppy Tooker. And when it comes to the quality of food in restaurants across our state, there's no contest. You're listening to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Jeremiah Tower. I'm a chef and author of cookbooks, and I'm a scuba diver. People ask me, well, do you have a business card? And I say, no. And they say, well, why not? And I said, well, I don't know what to put on it.
Well, I can think of a few things. Jeremiah Tower has had a legendary career that has spanned multiple countries and earned several awards. Beginning his career at Alice Waters Chez Panisse in Berkeley, Jeremiah transported his culinary vision along the California coast and all the way to Asia. Jeremiah became the subject of an impassioned documentary released in April 2017, produced by Cooking's bad boy, Anthony Bourdain. Before giving us the inside scoop on the film, Jeremiah took us back to his unlikely culinary origins.
Well, my training was being ignored by my parents, you know, which in the right location is an amazing education. I mean, they traveled all over the world first class with me. I went around the world twice before I was 16. But then, you know, when I was 30, my grandfather died and my allowance stopped. So I figured, you know, there was a terrible shock.
I bet.
That I had to actually work for a living, you know, and I didn't know what. I was trained as an architect in graduate school at Harvard. And then I went out on the world and it turns out I was a lousy architect. And then in San Francisco, I ran out of money, so I took the first job that I could find, which was as a chef in this little restaurant called Chez Panisse in Berkeley.
Oh, just some little restaurant in Berkeley called Chez Panisse.
Well, it was a little restaurant,
you
know.
How did you get the job as chef? What was your qualification?
Well, they were more desperate than I was. They said, come and be interviewed at 6 o'clock on a certain day, and I showed up at 6 o'clock. And, of course, that shows you how little they knew about the restaurant business, because at 6 o'clock is when your first customers are served. You don't give interviews, you know, then. So they said, oh, no, come, you know, we can't talk to you. Come back tomorrow. So I went out on the sidewalk, and then I thought, wait a minute. This just cost me $5.25 the bus here and to go back. So I went back inside, and I said, look, You told me to be here at 6 o'clock. I was, and I want my interview. And they said, no, we can't talk to you, can't talk to you. And Alice, well, I didn't know, but was standing there, and said, we'll do something to the soup. And there was this huge pot of soup, because everybody got soup, and there was only one menu for everyone. And I tasted it, and I added salt and cream, because I probably put cream in everything in those days. And they tasted it and went, wow. Come back tomorrow. And I did, and they interviewed me, and I gave them some menus. And the next thing I knew, I was the executive chef. And the first day I showed up, there was no one in the kitchen. I was on my own. So I just thought, well, I'm just going to cook whatever I know how to do, you know.
How long had Chez Panisse been open at the time you went to work there?
About a year.
Well, those were very exciting times.
Yes, and it's hard to for anyone to think back how simple those times were. When I say there were no fresh herbs, I mean, let's face it, everything in Whole Foods in those days didn't exist at all. No olive oil, no fresh herbs, no, I mean, the cheeses were Vella Jack, mm-hmm. which I didn't know, I'd never cooked with, didn't know how to cook with it properly. So I refused to cook with anything except perfect ingredients. And there weren't any. So we set about finding them. And that's where that foraging came from.
Well, you leave that sort of charming, intimate Chez Panisse, and not too terribly long later, you end up with the amazing phenomena that was Stars. Tell us about your time at Stars.
We could never have done Stars if I'd just gone cold into it the way I did at Chez Panisse. I had a team, a core team, together by that time. At the opening day, the people at the reception desk said to me, so what kind of restaurant is it? Of course, nobody had read the handbook that we'd handed out to the staff. So I said, well, you know, it's an American brasserie. And they said, what's the dress code? I said, everything from blue jeans to black tie. So at the end of the night, I went over to them and said, okay, so, you know, what was the feedback? And she said, every time I said American brasserie, everybody went, oh, yeah, fine. And I said, well, that's more than we know. I have no clue what an American brasserie is. And she said they loved everything from blue jeans to black tie, which, of course, is how it turned out. The food, again, we did the different menu every day. It was just whatever we wanted to do that you could do for 500 people for dinner, you know.
500 people, what an enormous number.
The most we ever did was 701. And that's when I was working the door. And the busboys were so terrified of me that they cleared the tables twice as fast. We did 701 instead of 500. And then the kitchen begged me never to be on the door again, you know.
So now at this point in your life, Anthony Bourdain decides to make a documentary about you. What did you think when he approached you about this? It must be a very odd and kind of spooky feeling at the same time.
Well, not as spooky as having to watch it. That's really weird. No, but when he asked me, I thought, hold on a second. 10 years ago, Anthony Bourdain said I was a traitor for leaving the industry, okay? A year or two after that, he said I was a train wreck. Then a couple of years after that, he said the first vaguely nice thing about me. And a couple of years after that, he's met him and he said, oh, Jeremiah, you know, I really admire you. And I'm thinking, you do? And then I met him in New York and he, you know, Anthony, of course, is incredibly charming. He's probably the most brilliant person I've ever met, the way he can verbalize all the huge knowledge that he has very well. I adore him. Anyway, so I said, yeah, okay. I mean, it's a very weird idea, but, you know, he's very persuasive. So I said, yeah. And they said, well, would you do a test? And then he told me a few things about meeting Alice Waters. When Anthony called her the Pol Pot of the culinary world, or the Khmer Rouge of the culinary world or something, and I just thought, that's pretty extreme, you know. So my private theory is that he was so pissed at Alice, he thought he'd do a movie about me.
Well, congratulations, no matter how it comes about.
Yeah, of course.
It's a wonderful thing to be immortalized like this. So how is it to watch yourself in a documentary? What are we going to see? and learn about you when we see this.
It's a very strange feeling. The first time I saw it, it was in a big theater, empty theater in New York, because the director, Lydia Tenaglia, who's brilliant from 0.0, she thought I'd be really pissed off, but I was actually too stunned, because it's to see yourself on the big screen, especially when, you know, it's a version of your life. Then the second time I saw it was at the Tribeca Film Festival on a big screen. And there was dead silence for what seemed like forever. It was probably 5 minutes, but it seemed like 20 minutes, you know. And I turned to Lydia sitting next to me and I said, run for it. And then some woman giggled and the whole place cracked up. So then it was fine. And I decided, you know, there's no point doing this unless you just blab.
Yeah.
You know, don't try and sculpt it, you know, for the best press or something. I mean, if it was going to be a fluff job, it would just be stupid. So I didn't. So the first question was, what was your father like? And out of my mouth, I was jet-lagged and tired and didn't have a glass of champagne. So I said, he was a prick. And I went, oh, my God, what have I just said? I don't know where that came from, you know, after, you know, 50 years of wanting to say it, I guess. I don't know. But once I'd said it, I thought, I relaxed and went, okay, whatever.
Well, you were certainly, I think, prepared to take that task on because you, of course, wrote a very, very frank memoir. And, you know, memoirs are very popular these days, but not everybody really manages to take such a long, hard look at themselves and just tell the truth. And you really pulled that off. How long ago did you write that book?
California Dish came out in 2003. That was the first book I wrote when I was in New York. And the new one, total remake of the book, comes out in April, called Start the Fire.
Well, I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
And I have to say, it has been such an incredible honor to have this opportunity to sit and visit and have this very frank conversation with one of the greats in American food, Jeremiah Tower. Thank you, Jeremiah.
Thank you, Bobby. The honor is mine.
Chef, restaurateur, and author, Jeremiah Tower. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau. And from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.